brought from the truck. Everyone had been kept away from the peak, so even the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center experts hadn't been able to get up there to conduct any examinations yet. All they had been able to do was make assumptions. A lot of snow had fallen, and avalanches were part of the natural order of things. Only so much snow can build up on the face of a mountain before it crumbles under its own weight and falls in the only direction it can, straight down. "It really isn't that unusual," replied Nick via the microphone attached to his headset.
"It's not the act itself that bothers me. It's the timing and ferocity," said Scott,
who noticed the peak looming up in front of them.
"Can the pilot get close enough to give me a good look at the face?"
"No can do. We don't know how unstable it is, and the rotor wash could trigger another slide. There's a small plateau in back near the top. He can set it down there, and we can work our way around on foot."
Vance turned around in the co-pilot seat so he could see Scott's face as he asked his next question.
"You think you're up to it?"
"Don't worry about me. You just get us there."
The hike to the face hadn't been as easy as Scott had hoped. The wind was blowing four times stronger at this elevation, and the chopper pilot needed three attempts before he was able to put down on the small plateau. Harvath was losing the feeling in his fingers from the cold, and the pain in his muscles was increasing with each passing minute. As the wind grew stronger, Nick suggested they rope up for safety. While Vance was handing the end of the rope to Scott, he asked,
"What exactly are we looking for up here?"
"Pornography," Scott replied.
Both Nick and Vance stopped what they were doing to look at him.
"Pornography?"
"It's an expression. I can't give you a good definition of pornography, but I know it when I see it. I'll know what we're looking for when I see it."
The group rounded the narrow ridge trail and began closing on the face of Squaw Peak. Vance led, with Scott next, followed by Nick. Harvath kept looking high and low, searching for anything that was out of the ordinary. He held up his hand and called out for Vance to stop. His climbing partners closed the gap and stood on either side of him.
"You see that?"
said Scott, motioning to a small crevice that had a pocket of chipped stone just above their heads.
"Sure do,"
said Nick.
"It looks like someone's been up here doing a little climbing, and it looks relatively recent," replied Vance.
"This area is technically off-limits, isn't it?" asked Scott.
Vance was the first to respond.
"It always is, especially during the winter and even more so with the president's visit. Heck, you were the one calling the shots. None of our guys were even allowed up here unless one of your men was with us."
"And did any of your guys come up here?"
"They would have needed to be cleared by either me or Nick. As far as I know, there were no requests, so neither of us cleared anyone."
Scott turned to Nick for confirmation, who nodded his head in agreement. 50 feet below them, Scott could see the shelf of snow and ice from which the avalanche had broken off. It wasn't hard to distinguish, as the levels of snow above and below were so dramatically different. Vance saw what Scott was looking at and immediately spoke.
"Let me guess."
"Yeah, I need to take a closer look."
Knowing he would be outvoted no matter what he said, Nick unshouldered his pack and began laying out the coils of rope they had brought along, leaving Vance to, hopefully, talk some sense into Agent Harvath as they untied their safety line.
"Scott, we have no idea how stable or unstable that shelf is down there."
"All the more reason I have to get down to it now."
"Can you explain to me what you hope to find down there?"
"I can't go into great detail, Vance, but I don't think that avalanche started on its own. I think somebody helped it."
"What, you think somebody triggered that avalanche on purpose? Why would somebody do that?"
"I don't have all the answers, but I'm starting to put together a picture. See that?"
Scott gestured toward where Nick had wisely chosen a new location in the rock crevice in which to drive a piton, so as not to disturb the area Harvath had pointed out earlier.
"I think somebody was up here, not too long ago, who hammered in one or several pitons, depending on how much support they needed, and belayed down the face."
"But that's nuts. No amateur backcountry climber would have done that."
"Who said anything about amateurs? These people were extremely professional."
"Even so, how do you know that their climbing caused the avalanche?"
I don't think the climbing caused it. As a matter of fact, I think whoever was responsible for the avalanche was long gone from here by the time it started. Are we ready up there, Nick?
Nick gave the thumbs up. He had placed a couple of extra pitons just to be sure, and threw Harvath a new length of rope on which he would be belayed.
Take this, said Harvath, throwing Nick an orange wax crayon he had removed from the command center. I want you to draw an X next to each one of the pitons you've placed, so that the investigative team can tell the difference between your work and what was here before we got here.
Nick nodded and began marking off his piton locations. Scott looped the rope through the metal ring in his harness and threw the coil of rope in his right hand over the ridge and down the face of Squaw Peak. Vance tied off a safety line to the harness and began giving Scott instructions.
You look like you know what you're doing, so I'm going to assume you've rappelled before.
More times and from more different objects than you can possibly imagine.
Scott grinned.
Well, this is going to be a little bit different. Because we have no idea how stable the snow is, you can't bounce down. You gotta walk back very slowly. Place your feet with extreme caution and listen very carefully for any cracking sounds that might indicate the shelf is moving or might be ready to break away. You got it?
Yeah, I got it, said Scott, as he turned his back to the ridge and the valley far below.
Looking over at Nick, he asked,
On belay?
Belay on,
Nick replied.
Climbing, said Scott,
which was followed by the mountaineer's response from Nick.
Climb on!
Ever so slowly, Scott leaned back into his harness and allowed himself to take baby steps over the lip of the ridge until he was standing on the icy face itself. He gave each of his balled fists a couple of quick squeezes to try and warm up his fingers before slowly letting out the slack in his rope. As Scott moved backward down the face, choosing each step with care, Nick released the necessary amounts of slack from the line. Harvath noticed divot-like depressions in the snow that could have been footprints or merely small wind-blown craters. It was hard to tell. The descent seemed to take forever as he moved step by step, always stopping to listen before lightly putting his weight on the next foot behind him. Scott's aching body was cooperating so far, but just barely. A small smile crossed his lips as he thought of what Dr. Trawick would have said had Scott asked permission to go climb a mountain. He probably would have certified him insane right there. Throughout the climb, Scott paid close attention to the strange pockmarks he was seeing in the snow, about 3 feet off to his left. He realized they were too uniform to be a naturally occurring phenomenon. What prevented him from believing they could be footprints was their small size. Then, it hit him. Scott looked up at his own marks made scaling down the face. His prints were about half the size of regular prints, and for good reason. When they had gotten out of the helicopter, Vance had handed him a pair of crampons. The sharp metal teeth strapped to his boots were the same devices that would have been worn by any climber, even a half-wit amateur, when trying to tackle a surface covered with snow and ice. Whoever left the tracks off to Scott's left did so knowing that by the time they were discovered, the person who made them would be hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away. Scott was nearing the edge of the shelf where the avalanche had broken away. He glanced again at the tracks left by the previous phantom climber and noticed they had begun to veer away from him. He steadied himself on the rope and carefully lifted his right hand to depress the talk button on the Deer Valley radio strapped to his chest.
Vance, do you read me? Over?
Yeah, I got ya. What's up?
We were right. Making my way down, I can see there's been somebody here recently with crampons.
Are you sure?
Sure enough. Listen, the trail diverges off to my left and then over the lip. I'm going to need to push off and swing over to where the tracks end. I'll need some slack. Give me about 20 more feet.
We'll let out the slack. Just be careful you don't touch off another slide, okay?
I'm being careful, and believe me, if you've got another way to do this, I'm all ears. At some point, I have to swing out over the lip, so I'd rather get it over with. Out.
Scott waited until he saw a sufficient amount of the line slide down the face and dangle beneath him. He calculated how much thrust he would need to push himself off the snow to reach his target, and hoped that using that much force wouldn't crack the shelf beneath him and send it tumbling into the valley below. There were a lot of rescue personnel and many of his fellow agents still combing the area down there for survivors. Scott was convinced the first slide had been no accident, but there was no telling what instabilities were left behind. Testing the strength in his legs, Scott bent painfully at the knees several times to get the momentum going to launch him in the right direction. Above, on the ridge, Vance and Nick could only hope Scott knew what he was doing, because they were operating completely blind.
On the count of three, Scott once again told himself. One, two, three.
The push sent him backward into the air, away from the steep peak face, and hurling toward the area beneath the shelf where the crampon tracks disappeared. Knees bent, ready to absorb the impact, Scott's body came back hard and fast toward its target. Judging by his speed, he thought that he had pushed off with a little too much force, and consequently was coming back in too fast. He braced himself for the impact. When the shark teeth-like crampons dug into the ice, the jolt raced up his legs, past where it should have been absorbed by his knees. Scott had misjudged his own strength. His knees had not yet fully forgiven him for the punishment they had suffered over the past 24 hours, and they failed to take the brunt of the shock. His legs buckled, and his whole upper body slammed into the sheer face. Scott didn't dare take either of his hands from the rope. Snow and ice began showering down on top of him. He could hear Vance calling frantically over the radio. The snow was beginning to fall faster, and Harvath knew he didn't have much time. Through the shower of snow, he quickly looked above him along the ridge as best he could, then looked down. Both above and below him, there were marks consistent with the detonation of some sort of explosive device. From the little he could see, it had not been the type of device fired by avalanche control cannons from the valley. The spread and pattern were completely different. When Scott let out a little more slack to drop closer to the area beneath him, he was hit from above by a sheet of ice that felt as if it weighed at least 100 pounds, and he was knocked right off the face. He tightened his grip frantically on his rope, knowing that it only had a finite amount of feet before it ran out. He cursed himself for being taken off guard by the ice sheet and loosening his grip in the first place. Scott fell with sickening speed, all the while fighting to regain control. He bumped his head several times, and then, with a loud snap, everything came to a halt. With the blood rushing to his head, Scott realized that he was hanging upside down by his safety line. He made a mental note to kiss Nick and Vance right after he punched both of their lights out for letting him fall so far. About 10 feet above him, he could see where his primary rope had come to its end. Knowing, or actually hoping, Nick and Vance would be doing their best to pull him back up to the ridge, Scott summoned what strength he could and tried to right himself. His body was weak and sore, but it complied. As he swung back into the face and dug in with his crampons, Scott promised himself that very soon, he'd take that long overdue vacation. 23. Back in the helicopter, Scott accepted Vance and Nick's excuse for letting so much slack on the safety line escape. He also decided not to punch both of their lights out. As Vance explained it to Scott, while he lay exhausted yet safely supine back upon the ridge, Scott's slam into the face of Squaw Peak had caused what they all feared, a secondary avalanche. It was small and came to a stop well before it could cause harm to anyone below in the valley, but Scott had acted like a magnet for the falling snow and ice, which piled on top of him and exponentially increased his weight upon the rope. Pitons were popping left and right, and both Vance and Nick thought for sure they would be yanked over the edge. Neither of them ever even considered letting go. That just simply wasn't an option. They were able finally to dig in and get control of Scott's fall at the very last minute. The burn marks in their gloves attested to their courage and Scott's extremely good fortune. He wanted to kiss the guys, but before he could, a voice from the Deer Valley helipad came over the headset. It instructed the pilot to return to the pad to shuttle an FBI team to a crime scene in nearby Midway.
Midway?
Scott leaned forward and said while tapping Vance on the shoulder,
"That's just the other side of the mountain, isn't it? What do you suppose is going on over there?"
Vance was reading Scott's mind. He radioed back to Deer Valley, asking where the FBI team was to be taken. As the information was relayed across the headsets, the pilot nodded that he knew where it was, and Vance pointed for the pilot to go in that direction.
"Let me guess, you're going to take responsibility for this one too?"
queried Nick. Scott only smiled and asked the pilot if there was a pass or anything like that connecting the area around Death Chute to the farm they were headed toward in Midway.
"There are a couple, but only one that could be considered a pass in the sense that it can be completely traversed," replied the pilot.
"Do me a favor and follow it," said Scott.
Vance turned in the co-pilot seat and asked,
"What are you thinking?"
"Just a hunch."
"Great,"
said Nick, leaning his head against the window of the chopper and staring up at the ceiling.
"Another hunch. Let's see if we can get fired on this hunch, or better yet, maybe we can actually get killed this time."
"Not a chance,"
said Scott, as he placed a thankful and reassuring hand on Nick's shoulder.
"When the helicopter touches down, I'm getting out, and you're going back to Deer Valley."
"Too bad,"
said Vance, turning back around in his seat to look out the front.
"This was just starting to get interesting."
Before jumping out of the helicopter, Harvath thanked his friends and asked the pilot to do him a favor and make sure the FBI got to enjoy some of the Wasatch Mountains' scenic beauty on their way over. The pilot laughed and gave him the thumbs up. Scott straightened up once he was sure he had cleared the rotor blades and walked over toward the three Wasatch County Sheriff's Department Suburbans parked in front of the Maddox's farmhouse.
"FBI," said a deputy sheriff, as Harvath approached, digging his credentials from his pocket.
"Secret Service. I'm Agent Harvath, head of
the President's advance team. I remember reading your name on the memo that came around about the visit. I'm Ben McIntyre, deputy sheriff. You working with the FBI on this?"
"Yeah. Whenever the President is involved or we think there may be some sort of connection, we tackle these things together,"
lied Harvath, right through his teeth.
"Why don't you fill me in on what you've got?"
Deputy McIntyre removed a small notebook from the breast pocket of his coat and started reading. "About 7:30 this morning, we got a call from the daughter of the old couple that lives here, Joseph and Mary Maddox. Apparently, after church yesterday, they passed up on the normal Sunday dinner at the daughter's house because the father wasn't feeling well. The daughter tried to check in with them a couple of times last night and couldn't get a hold of anyone. She thought maybe they'd turned in early, and being older folks, just didn't hear the phone. So, this morning, she tries again, several times, and there's still no answer. Word that they might have been in an accident or something, she called our office and asked if we'd swing by."
"Your office?" asked Harvath. "Why didn't she come herself?"
"She lives down in Orem," said the deputy, referring back to his notes. "It's a pretty long drive up here, especially with the weather. Plus, she works and didn't think the boss would let her. A couple of our guys know, or I should say knew, the Maddoxes, so they didn't mind coming out."
"Knew? They're dead?"
"Yep. Mr. Maddox was shot close range to the head, and Mrs. Maddox suffered multiple gunshot wounds."
"Have you contacted your sheriff?"
"Yes, sir. He's been over with your people in Deer Valley working the avalanche, but now he's on his way back here with the FBI. We also have our medical examiner on the way, as well as a homicide team coming up from Salt Lake County. The highway patrol and the state park rangers are buttoning down all the roads around here."
"Well done, deputy. You did everything by the book. As I was already in the air, I was routed here first. Has anyone touched anything inside?"
"Nope. The first officer on the scene had his winter gloves on and only took them off to check for a pulse on each of the victims. He tracked a little snow inside, but we've laid down some plastic, so that ought to lessen the contamination of the scene."
"Good job. I trust your sheriff told you no one else was to be allowed in until he arrived with the FBI?"
"He certainly did."
"Good.
Make sure you send them in to me when they get here.
Sir, my orders are that no one gets in until the sheriff and the FBI get here.
Deputy, when do you think the sheriff called me?
He called you, sir?
When do you think he called me? Before he talked to you or after?
Well, he didn't know about anything till I called him, so it would have to be after.
Exactly. So when the sheriff told you to keep the scene secure until he got here, that was before he knew I was already airborne and could get here faster.
Uh-huh.
Deputy, I don't need to draw you a picture. You're a smart man.
By now, you've figured out that if the sheriff is coming all the way over with the FBI, and the head of the president's advance team is already here, this is some pretty serious stuff.
Yes, sir. Listen, I've done a lot of advance work in some very out-of-the-way places. Most of the county sheriffs we work with would make Gomer Pyle look like an astrophysicist. I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. Your department does a damn good job. I don't want you to get in any hot water with your boss, but I have my own boss to think about, and he's the President of the United States. Now, if you'll cut me a little slack, I can get started and have a preliminary report for the FBI guys when they get here. What do you say?
I guess so. We were told to cooperate with the Secret Service with anything they needed.
Good man. Where are the victims?
Master bedroom. Second floor, down the hall on the left. Do me a favor and wear these. We want to keep the crime scene as uncontaminated as possible, said the deputy, pulling out a pair of paper surgical booties from a box in the back seat of his truck.
Thanks, said Scott, accepting the paper booties and a pair of latex surgical gloves while walking up the steps of the house. I meant what I said. You guys are pretty impressive.
A piece of plastic had been laid in front of the storm door, and Scott stood on it while he took his Timberlands off and slipped on the booties. Snapping on the rubber gloves, he opened the double doors. As a non-smoker, Scott immediately detected the lingering odors of cigarette smoke. The smell grew stronger as Scott neared the family room. He quickly turned and walked back to the front door. Catching the attention of one of the Wasatch County officers, he asked,
Officer, do you know if Mr. and Mrs. Maddox are Mormon?
Scott noticed a slight change in the face of the officer, and, catching his faux pas, switched to the more politically correct term preferred these days by the Mormons.
I'm sorry. I mean, were they members of the LDS Church?
Pleased that an outsider would show such respect for their faith, the officer responded,
Yes, sir. Mr. Maddox had been our bishop for a long time. He retired a ways back, but we still saw him at church and at all the functions.
I see, replied Scott. I take it by your answer that you are a member of the church as well.
Yes, I am.
And you abide by all the church covenants?
I certainly do.
So you don't smoke?
No, sir. Never.
How about Mr. and Mrs. Maddox? Did either of them smoke?
No, sir. I can tell you as sure as I'm standing here that they were perfect examples of what members of the Church of Latter-day Saints should be.
Harvath turned his attention back to Deputy McIntyre.
Ben, could there have been any of your guys smoking in here?
No way. Why?
How about near the front door at all?
Not a one. What are you getting at?
Without answering, Harvath turned back inside, closing both doors behind him. He needed to see the bodies. How they were killed and how they were placed would hopefully tell him something about the killers. The scenic route Scott had asked the Deer Valley helicopter pilot to take would delay the FBI for only so long. With his eyes wide open and all of his senses operating at their peak, he climbed the creaking stairs to the second floor.
Talk about a time warp, Scott thought,
as he looked down the hallway at the green shag carpeting.
At what point in the aging process do people just give up and let time pass them by?
At the top of the stairs, he noticed a door ajar directly in front of him. Walking over to it, he pushed it the rest of the way open with his foot. It smelled of strongly perfumed soap, exactly the way a bathroom in a grandmother's house should smell. Everything was neatly in place, except for a towel that appeared to have been hung hastily back on the rack next to its neatly folded twin. Scott looked into the tub, which was perfectly dry. Next, he checked the wash basin, and it too was dry,
except for a little pool of moisture around the drain. He noticed that the faucet had a very slow drip. Scott tightened the handle, and the dripping stopped. Judging from the little bit he had already seen of the place, he knew the Maddoxes kept one neat and clean house. Someone other than the Maddoxes had used this sink recently and had been careless both with turning off the water and with hanging the towel. Leaving the bathroom, Scott made his way down the hall toward where the deputy had said the master bedroom was. He passed rows and rows of photographs of family vacations, picnics, weddings, and posed Kmart shots of what must have been the grandchildren. The whole array was hung in chronological order. What he assumed were pictures of Mr. and Mrs. Maddox in their youth were at the beginning of the hall, and the display transitioned into their later years as one got closer to the master bedroom. Each night, they would have actually relived their lives on the way to bed. It gave Scott an eerie chill to think that the final posing of the two would be at the very end of the hallway, where they lay in death. And posing was a perfect word for it. Scott entered the room and saw the couple laid out on their bed. The killer hadn't surprised them in bed because they were both fully clothed and were lying on a white chenille bedspread, now puddled with patches of rusty brown. There were also marks along the floor, undoubtedly caused when one of them had fallen and been dragged and then slung onto the bed. The damage to Mr. Maddox was consistent with a professional hit, concise, cold, and accurate. Mrs. Maddox's injuries were anything but. With half her nose blown away and additional gunshot wounds to her neck, chest, head, and face, it looked as if someone had lost control or was in a complete and total rage. The gruesome scene was going to keep the police, the sheriff, and the FBI busy for a while. As Scott had been flown from Deer Valley to Midway, a theory had formed in his mind. One of the biggest questions he had, outside of how the kidnappers had been able to ambush and take out the president's detail, was how they had gotten away. Everything he had seen so far served to reinforce that these people were absolute professionals. Each precise detail had been planned and probably practiced until it was perfect. Aside from assaulting a structure like the White House or Fort Knox, it was hard to think of a more daring, more dangerous, or more difficult undertaking than this. Yet, the kidnappers had succeeded. The FBI would sweep the room for hair, fibers, and prints, and would also look to see if the killer had left any other sort of clue, such as a note or a distinctive marking. Scott was positive they wouldn't find any notes. Psychos who wanted to get caught left notes, taunting the police and feds. While Scott couldn't pass judgment on how psychotic this killer was, he knew one thing for sure. He was professional. Scott tried to put the killings in context. If the FBI was on their way here, chances were pretty good that they were thinking the same thing he was. The kidnappers would have needed a base. The only way off Death Chute was by foot or helicopter. With the weather the way it had been yesterday, there was no way a chopper would have been able to get there. Plus, a helicopter would have made too much noise. The surrounding mountains acted as one big echo chamber. Only a craft with super silent capabilities would have been quiet enough to get in there undetected. Harvath thought about that for a second, not yet ready to rule it out. Flying low enough, a stealth helicopter could have evaded the radar, monitored by the Secret Service agents who had been posted with the FAA in the tower and approach control at Salt Lake International Airport and breached the protective no-fly zone over Deer Valley. The sophistication of the jamming device Hollenbeck had found demonstrated loud and clear that the kidnappers had access to some very high-tech equipment. But the one element that didn't fit was the human element, the pilots. Even U.S. Night Stalker pilots, the best in the world, couldn't have tackled that storm last night. In normal conditions, the downdrafts around the valley were amazingly tough to handle. As Scott thought further, assembling a mental picture of the area where the bodies of the president's detail were found, he realized there wasn't enough room to land any sort of helicopter. Scott ran down how it might have happened. What if the kidnappers were able to get their hands on a helicopter with stealth capabilities? And what if they could find a pilot crazy enough to tackle the downdrafts? And what if the pilot was good enough to do it in a raging snowstorm? And what if he could land in a heavily treed area that didn't provide enough space? Would it have been possible?
Absolutely not, thought Scott.
That was too many what-ifs. The kidnappers would have had to ski down the mountain along a route they were relatively confident would not allow for them to be spotted, and then rendezvous with some sort of transport that would either facilitate their escape or be an intermediary step along the way. When the Deer Valley helicopter had flown Scott over the only serviceable pass to Midway, the pilot had told him the other routes would be traversable only if you brought climbing gear. Plus, they switched back on themselves often and would take double and in some cases triple the time. When Scott had asked if a four-wheel drive vehicle could make it through the pass, the pilot had said it was possible. But why would you use a Jeep when a snowmobile would be so much faster? Reaching the bottom landing again, his nose and the smell of cigarette smoke led Scott back into the family room. He stood for several moments with his eyes closed, trying to put himself in the mind of the killer. The Maddoxes were not smokers, so it must have been the killer who had lit up, and more than once. That heavy smoke smell didn't come from just one cigarette, so he'd had time for more than one. Why? Simple. He was waiting. Scott's mind began to turn faster. Waiting for what? His colleagues, the kidnappers, to arrive with the president? He waited right in this room and smoked. What else did he do? Scott looked around the room. There were no books or magazines, but there was a television set. He walked over and turned it on. After a few moments, the set warmed up enough, and its picture popped to life. Where would he have sat? Harvath looked behind him and spotted what must have been Mr. Maddox's Lazy Boy recliner. It had Man of the House written all over it. Knowing he was compromising the crime scene, but needing desperately to put the pieces of the puzzle together, Scott sat down in the chair and extended the tattered leg rest by pulling on the worn handle. The old Lazy Boy lurched backward as the footrest sprang up, placing him in a very comfortable position.
If the killer had been smoking, he would have needed an ashtray and a place to set it. He could have rested it all on his chest as he waited and watched TV. But if he'd gone to this extent to make himself comfortable, why not use the end table immediately to his left?
Scott scanned the items that sat on the end table. There was a TV guide with a ring on its cover where a glass had been placed, a few knitting needles that probably belonged to Mrs. Maddox, a pair of reading glasses, and a couple of coasters.
Coasters? Why would there be a moisture ring on the TV guide if there were coasters right on the end table?
That didn't seem to jibe with the fastidiousness that reigned throughout this house. Scott mimicked smoking, imagining the killer had used a pop can or something similar for the ashes, and let his left hand trail back toward the table, where he believed the makeshift ashtray would have been. The movement was difficult, not just because of his sore muscles, but because of the position of the end table. The killer would have needed to rotate his torso and actually look at what he was doing, or he would have missed his target. Scott thought the chances were pretty good that he had missed once or twice, and jumped out of the chair to test his theory. Examining the edges along the surface of the end table, he saw a grayish powdery dust that could have been cigarette ash, but only a lab would have been able to tell at this point. Dropping to his knees, Scott searched along the bottom of the table and found what he was looking for. Resting in the fibers of the matted orange carpeting were indeed cigarette ashes. The killer had obviously missed. Then, something else caught his eye. The end table was between the Lazy Boy and the long couch. Judging from the wear on the couch cushion closest to the end table, that was where Mrs. Maddox sat, while Mr. Maddox occupied the Lazy Boy and the two watched TV. Underneath the couch was something dark and square. Scott reached under and pulled it out. He held it up to the light coming in through the window. It was a piece of chocolate, perfectly square, that had been broken off from a larger bar. It was stamped with a distinct N, which Scott recognized as being the monogram of Nestle, and the almost imperceptible word Lieber across the N. Conscious of the heat in his fingers, Scott transferred the chocolate square into his palm and walked across the entry hall into the kitchen, hoping the Maddoxes had some Ziploc bags. He placed the chocolate on the edge of the counter by the sink and started rummaging through the drawers underneath. In the fourth drawer, he found what he was looking for. Scott crossed to the refrigerator, took several ice cubes from the freezer, and dropped them into the larger of the two Ziploc bags. He then put the piece of chocolate into the smaller bag, zipped it, and placed it into the larger bag to keep it cold. He slipped the package into his outside parka pocket and turned his attention to the garbage can under the sink. There wasn't much garbage, and nothing that could have been used to ash a cigarette into. As Scott was closing the cabinet door that hid the trash can, he heard the telltale signs of an approaching helicopter. Leaning against the sink, Scott looked out the window above it to see if he could make out the approaching FBI team. Nothing yet, but they would be here very soon. As his mind raced through what else he should be looking for, Scott looked down at the dish rack to his left with its three upturned glasses. He upended them one by one, placing his nose inside and inhaling deeply. With the second one, his hunch was confirmed. After placing the glasses back in their original positions and running back to the family room to right the lazy boy, Scott closed the front doors behind him and put the paper booties in his pocket as he laced up his Timberlands.
"Looks like the gang is on approach," said Deputy McIntyre, as Scott finished tying his shoes and came down the front steps of the house toward the assorted police vehicles.
"It's about time," replied Scott.
"You learn anything while you were in there?"
"Nah, not really. Pretty much as you called it. I know it's been snowing a bit, but did you fellas find any tire tracks or anything out here on the perimeter?"
"Yeah, some pretty big mothers."
"Really? How big?"
"Looks like maybe a big rig, 18-wheeler, came right up to the barn. There were some others, like one of them big flatbed pickups that uses the doubled-up tires in back, but only singles in front, and some other single-tread tracks behind the barn, probably snowmobiles."
"That sounds like a lot of activity, Deputy."
"Well, in the winter, the farmers get a lot of snowmobilers across their property, so that might be where the ones across the back of the barn came from. The doubled-up tires could have come from any number of neighbors around here. That's Mr. Maddox's pickup over there, and he's got singles, so it wasn't from him. Those 18-wheeler-looking tracks are a little more confusing. The way it was backed up to the barn makes me think there might have been a drop-off or something."
"Or a pickup. Did you or your men look inside the barn?"
"Nope. We were going to, but that's about the time we made contact with the sheriff, and he told us to secure the area and hold off on anything further until he got here."
"Yeah, he was probably right."
"My guess is," said Scott, gesturing to the incoming helicopter, "that they'll want to check out the victims first, then they'll look over the house, then they'll start their search of the other buildings. I'm going to get the outer search started. After they search the house, do me a favor and send them over to the barn, will you? Thanks."
Scott finished with his most engaging smile and made his way to the barn. He was walking quickly while trying not to attract any undue attention. The roar of the chopper could be heard from just overhead. Scott knew he'd been blessed with more time on this crime scene than he should ever have had. Thankfully, the barn wasn't locked, and he was able to slip inside and shut the door behind him just as the Deer Valley helicopter touched down outside. It took Scott's eyes a minute to adjust to the diminished light, and while he waited, he filtered through the mess of tire tracks he had seen leading to the door. The snow made it difficult to perfectly identify what had made them, but Scott had to give the deputy from Wasatch County another 10 points. His interpretation of the tracks was probably right on the money. Casts would confirm things for sure. But what Scott was trying to do now was create the best picture he could of what happened. His eyes adjusted. He walked around the edges of the large dirt floor, hugging what, in Mr. Maddox's younger days, had probably been horse and pig stalls, trying not to trample on any evidence. The floor was a maze of all sorts of different tracks. Scott could see that the snowmobile tracks led from the back door of the barn, across the floor, and stopped at a deep horizontal groove in the dirt floor. The picture was becoming clearer now. Scott knew that if the falling snow hadn't obscured them completely, he could probably open the back door of the barn and find that the tracks would lead all the way back through the pass to a secluded spot somewhere adjacent to Death Chute. Suddenly, the barn was awash with light. It fell across his shoulders and landed on the floor in front of him. That light, coupled with a cold wind on the back of his neck, told Scott the FBI had decided to take up their investigation of the barn more quickly than he'd thought they would. Without turning around, he knew exactly who was standing behind him. 24.
Only if this farm had a woodshed would there be a more appropriate place for me to tan your hide, came the voice of the FBI's number two man, Gary Lawler, who was standing between the open barn doors. Just what the hell have you been doing?
Before turning to face him, Scott slipped off the latex gloves and shoved them inside his parka.
You can hand those goddamn gloves right over to me. That way I won't leave any fingerprints, and when they find your body, they won't be able to link it to me.
Gary, just wait a second, began Harvath.
First of all, this isn't a fucking social call, Agent Harvath. You address me as Deputy Director or Agent Lawler, you understand me? And secondly,
wait a second?
How dare you tell me to wait a second, boy? Who the hell do you think you are?
Do you want me to answer that, or are you just going to run right over what I have to say?
Shut up!
There's my answer.
You know what, Scott? You're a real wise ass. That's always been your problem. You're a great operative, but your mouth gets in the way too often. It's beyond me how you ever made it through the Navy, especially the SEALs.
I guess that recommendation from the special agent in charge of the San Diego FBI field office went a long way.
It must have. I don't know what I was thinking when I wrote that for you.
You did it because you knew that's where I wanted to be. You knew I had certain talents and that they could teach me things that...
Yeah? Really? Did the Navy teach you that it was okay to assault a federal officer? Did they teach you that it was okay to trespass on not one, not two, but three secured FBI crime scenes and, while you're on one of them, start an avalanche that not only would bury potentially critical evidence, but might also endanger the lives of hundreds of rescue workers and investigators down below? And while I'm at it, what are you, in the fucking tour business now? If it hadn't been for the sheriff knowing where we were going, that fucking helicopter pilot would have gone by the way of New Jersey to get here. I know you had something to do with that.
Jesus, Gary. I lost at least 30 men, good men, all on my watch. I was responsible for each and every one of those guys. Most of them have families. What do you expect me to do?
Lawler's incredulous voice rose to a level that could be heard well outside the barn.
What would I expect you to do? I would expect you to honor the oath you took to uphold the laws of this country. That's what I would expect you to do.
Scott stood and stared at Lawler. Of all people, this was someone he'd thought would understand him, understand what he was doing. After Scott's SEAL instructor father was killed in a training exercise, Gary Lawler, a longtime friend of the family, had become like a second father to him. While they didn't always see eye to eye on things, Scott felt Gary should at least cut him some slack because of their history. The problem Lawler had right now went far beyond their relationship, though. Scott needed to be put back in line. His voice calmer, Lawler said,
Scott, you're in a lot of trouble. Do you understand that? You've completely thrown the book out the window.
What would you be doing in my place?
Damn it, Scott, are you that thick? We're not talking about me, and we're not talking about the realm of possibilities. We're talking about what you have done and the trouble you're in.
Let me ask you a question.
You do realize the president has been kidnapped, and I have absolutely no time for this.
How did you nail the guys from the Scripps bombing? Did you do it by your precious book that you seem to place above everything else?
Scott had just touched a very deep and painful nerve. Harvath was referring to a standoff at the Scripps Howard Institute in La Jolla, California, over 10 years ago, when Gary was in charge of the FBI's San Diego field office. A radical group had taken over the facility and were holding several of its staff hostage. When the FBI's hostage rescue team assaulted the building after a week-long standoff, they weren't prepared for what they found inside. The strength of the terrorist group was twice what they had expected, and the terrorists had anticipated every route the FBI would take in assaulting the building. All of those areas were rigged with charges. Men that weren't mowed down by automatic weapons fire were blown to pieces by the explosives. Lawler was the type who would never ask men to do anything he wouldn't do himself. He had been on the winning side of several high-profile kidnappings, raids, and assorted tougher-than-hell cases before and since the Scripps incident, but he could never shake the feeling that somehow he should have known what was waiting inside that building for the HRT team. It had taken Lawler 3 years, but he had managed to track down every single member of the radical group responsible for the planning and execution of the Scripps disaster as it became known. Some of the perpetrators came in peacefully, some needed to be coerced, and some went out with guns blazing, but Lawler's bullets always found their targets first. Several of the group's members fled the country, foolishly thinking they would be beyond FBI's grasp, but Lawler still found them. Money and time were no object. Lawler had made an impassioned plea to the government that it must be a priority to bring these people to justice, and that he must be in charge of doing it. Scott knew Lawler broke more than a few laws and trampled upon more than a few civil rights along the way, but he got the job done. It was precisely that feeling of responsibility that Scott was trying to evoke in Lawler. Gary snapped too, realizing he had been drawn into a place in his mind he didn't want to be. That was a long time ago, and it has no bearing whatsoever on what is happening now, he said.
So, do as I say, not as I do? Jesus, Gary, it's a shame you never had kids. You've got all the good parental lines down pat.
You don't know when to quit, do you? The SAC of our Salt Lake office wants your ass bronzed and hanging above his desk for cold-cocking one of his men.
The guy deserved it.
That doesn't matter. You still assaulted a federal officer, and it happened on my playing field in my investigation. Plus, there's all the other crap you've pulled. Not only is your behavior way out of line, but according to the medical report I read on you, you shouldn't have even gotten out of bed this morning.
Gary, come on. You know how important this is.
You bet I do. I'm the one who has to feed the hourly reports back to Washington so the director can brief the vice president. If nothing else, you should know the importance of being a team player.
Yeah, but I belong on the field, not on the bench. I was responsible for those men, and I am ultimately responsible for the president. You've lost guys before, Gary. You've got to know how that feels, how I feel.
Lawler had had enough. You know what? Trying to pull my chain is going to get you fucking nowhere, pal. Understand me? What happened at Scripps was a long time ago. How I cleaned it up was also a long time ago. I was operating under a federal directive that you don't have the clearance or the need to know anything about. I have made a lot of mistakes in my life, and one of them was thinking I could talk some sense into you and help get your ass out of the fire, but you keep on pushing me. Scott was growing equally angry and fired right back at Lawler.
Pushing you? So this is about you now? For as long as I've known you, it's all been about you.
That's not true, and you know it.
Where do you think my life and career are going to be when the dust finally settles on this? Have you given any thought to that?
At this point, that's not my problem. But I can tell you that you're not making things any easier on yourself with all this fucking around.
That's what you think I'm doing. Fucking around. What's fucking around is sitting on our asses for hours, burning precious time, waiting for you to get here so the investigation can be carried forward. That was a colossal fuck around.
You know what? You just stepped on my very last nerve. You don't know when someone is trying to give you a hand, do you? I'm going to spell it out for you, and you damn well better listen. We are effective because we are organized. I don't care how many movies you watch. The rogue cowboy never helps get anything done. He screws up the entire works.
It is through cooperation, specialization, and division of the investigative labors that any investigation succeeds. It is not the efforts of one man that count, but of hundreds, sometimes thousands. When you go off half-cocked because you don't like how things are going, you not only screw things up, as in any evidence we might have been able to uncover on Squaw Peak, but you are turning your back on your team. When you turn your back on your team, you forego the rights and associations thereto. Now, I can understand how you're feeling, but that does not, for one single moment, excuse your behavior. You have broken the law, and, on top of your other problems, you might have to face the music on some serious charges. You think you were fucked before? Well, any compassion that might have been available to you because of your heroic efforts in saving the president's daughter have been thrown right out the window by none other than you yourself. I can see your mind working, and I'm going to tell you right now, Scott, to keep your big mouth shut. I'm telling you for your own good. You might still have a career that's salvageable, but if you step out of line one more time, I guarantee you, I will personally see that you get every single thing that's coming to you. Do you get me? And don't open your mouth to say yes. Just nod your head. Anger burned within every pore in his body like acid, but slowly, reluctantly, Harvath nodded his head. Good, said Lawler, who turned and walked out of the barn. Waving to get the attention of Deputy McIntyre, he yelled, I need one of your men to drive Agent Harvath back to the Secret Service Command Center at Snow Haven. I have had about all the investigative help from him that I can stand. And while I'm thinking of it, absolutely no stopping for anything. Back in Deer Valley, FBI agent Zushnit, feeling the vibration of his pager, looked at the display and then fished in his pocket for quarters. He could have used his cell phone, but this was yet another call he didn't want traced back to him. 25. Scott fumed all the way back to the command center. The hypocritical bullshit Lawler was shoveling was too much. He knew damn well that Lawler probably bowed, bent, and broke every rule in the book during his search for the people responsible for killing his fellow FBI agents. Nobody blamed him at all, and knowing Lawler, nobody probably even dared to stand in his way. In all fairness to Gary, Scott understood that there was a chain of command and a way things needed to be done for the sake of effectiveness. He'd been in the Navy, after all. But the unassailable fact here was that Scott had lost 30 men and the president was missing. No matter what Lawler said, Scott's career was in his own hands, and the only thing that would turn the tide in his favor was if he stumbled upon something that broke the investigation wide open. He'd assembled a few clues, but nothing earth-shattering. Lawler wouldn't listen to him at this point anyway, so he was back where he'd started, on his own. Harvath hopped out of Deputy McIntyre's Suburban before it had even come to a stop, and, flashing his credentials at the gate, was shown through. He made his way to the Winnebago and bounded up the stairs, hoping to find Palmer inside. She was in back, working at the same table Longo had been at earlier. Glancing up from her laptop, she saw Scott coming down the narrow hallway. Well, someone's been a busy boy today. Very funny. Who's being funny? Yuck, yuck, yuck. Any news? We got a couple of breaks. I'm all ears. Well, we got a confirmation back on the Middle Easterner. Name's Hassan Youssef. The Mossad ID'd him. He was a freelance sniper who worked for many of the pro-Palestinian liberation groups. In particular, some of the more radical splinter factions of the PLO. He had been tied to several high-profile assassinations in Israel. Hmm, said Scott. Well, that does and doesn't make sense. What do you mean? The weapon he was found with was a scorpion. It makes sense in that the scorpion is one of the preferred weapons of the PLO, but it's predominantly a defensive weapon. The long-range accuracy isn't that good. And because it's so small, on fully automatic, it's more of an S&P. S&P? Sorry, it's a term from my past. S&P means spray and pray. The Scorpion cuts a wide swath when it's set to full auto,
and the shooter just sprays bullets and prays he hits his target. You know, a room broom.
But what if it wasn't set on fully auto?
Well, it can hold a 10 to 20 round magazine. But why wouldn't a sniper use a more accurate and dependable weapon? Maybe he had one and his buddies took it with them.
And what? Left him with a weapon that screams PLO? It doesn't make sense.
Scott took a seat next to Agent Palmer as his eyes glazed over in thought.
When you were in the SEALs, didn't you ever carry any American-made weaponry?
His mind half on what Palmer had said, and half somewhere else, Scott answered,
"It depended on the mission. But we would never leave one of our men or any of our equipment behind. In and out, without a trace, was our M.O.
You know, I once dated a SEAL, and if he had applied the same policies to my bathroom, instead of leaving behind a minefield of wet towels and toilet seats in the up position, we might still be together. Palmer laughed, trying to help lift the intense mood Scott had slipped into, but it didn't work.
You like chocolate, right?
Show me a woman who doesn't, answered Palmer.
And all that stuff you brought back from your trip to Europe last year.
You mean the chocolate that I brought back and left in the duty room at the White House, that you piglets wolfed down and didn't even leave me a piece of?
Yeah, that would be the chocolate I'm talking about.
What about it?
Where'd you get it?
I mean, did you buy it at the duty-free, or did you go to specialty shops?
Well, let me see. I kind of bought it all over. I was traveling by train on one of those Eurail passes, and it was nice to have it to snack on. I just picked it up here and there.
Any place in particular? Palmer tried to jog her memory.
I started my trip in Belgium, and since they're really known for their chocolate, I think I bought a good supply at a shop across the street from the train station. That lasted me through France, and when I got to Austria, I picked up some Mozart's balls.
Mozart's balls?
When you say it in German, it's not as dirty.
And after Austria?
Let me think. After Austria... Oh, yeah. After Austria, I went to Switzerland. They are really famous for chocolate, but I think it's more like milk chocolate they're famous for. The Belgians do a lot of fancy things with chocolate, but not so much the Swiss. The Belgians would put chocolate on a cheeseburger and try to sell it, while the Swiss really seem to like milk chocolate bars. Next, I went to Italy, and they had those awesome bocce balls. Sorry, back up a sec.
What?
About the Swiss.
Nestle is a Swiss chocolate maker, right?
Yeah,
they make Nestle Crunch Bars, and I think that coffee-made creamer stuff.
Right, those are a couple of the products we have here in the States, but what about in Europe?
In Switzerland, they make tons of different products. They make chocolate, but they also make things like baby food.
Well, let's stick with the chocolate.
Fine. From what I saw in Switzerland, there were lots of different varieties of Nestle chocolate.
And if they were going to import or try a particular brand here in the U.S., they would probably give the chocolate a name in English, right?
Maybe, maybe not.
Why do you say that?
Take something like Toblerone or Bocce. Neither of them changed their names when they exported to the U.S. from Europe. But those are one of those deals where the European company has built its entire identity around that one brand. The identity is the name of the chocolate, so they don't change it. If there were a Nestle product that was kind of known in Switzerland, but not super famous, I think they would have their marketing people here come up with a new name for it. And let's face it, the U.S. market for fine chocolate with foreign-sounding names has got to be a lot smaller than the market for something like Snickers.
That's a good point.
Hey, I didn't get to where I am by being stupid, said Palmer with another warm smile.
I'm beginning to worry about you, though. Let's get off this chocolate subject. I'm sure Nestle has a website.
It'll either be a .com or a .ch for Switzerland.
Thanks, Palmer. I appreciate it, said Scott, standing to leave.
Where are you going?
I haven't had anything to eat since that wonderful breakfast you cooked me this morning. I was thinking about walking down to the restaurant at the Silver Lake Lodge to grab a bowl of chili.
Want some company? I could probably take my break a little early.
No, thanks anyway. I need to be alone and get some things straight.
I understand. Stick your head in when you get back.
Okay.
Scott quickly shut the door of the Winnebago behind him so as not to let too much cold air in and piss off the other agents inside. As he reached the bottom step, he heard the door open behind him. Palmer peeked her head around the door.
There was one other thing. There might not be a connection, but an ambulance was found abandoned on the west side of the valley, over by the Kennecott Copper Mine.